Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Let's set the stage for tonight's show. The man who is perhaps the most litigious person in the country seeks to return to his position as the world's most powerful person. And you share a history. You find yourself going into a fierce and bloody courtroom battle. First, let me introduce tonight's co-host, well-known and newly retired lawyer David Begelizen. David?
Thank you, Jeffrey. Tonight, we have two very, very distinguished guests. E. Jean Carroll is the author of 7 books. The most recent one is entitled Not My Type. It's about a brutal sexual assault upon her in the dressing room of the Bergdorf Goodman department store a little less than 30 years ago in New York City. It's about 2 jury trials in the United States District Court in the Southern District of New York. It's about 2 jury verdicts, one of about $5 million and the second one of roughly $83 million. It's also about her assailant, Donald John Trump. Also with us is Ms. Carroll's lawyer, Roberta Kaplan, otherwise known as Robbie Kaplan. Ms. Kaplan is a graduate of Harvard College and Columbia Law School. After many years with the distinguished law firm of Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton, and Garrison, she started her own firm. Ms. Kaplan was the lead lawyer in the Windsor case before the United States Supreme Court. You might think that tax law is boring. Not that case. And the Windsor case paved the way toward marriage equality, and which was the landmark before the United States Supreme Court. She also led the way in the civil rights case against the rioters in Charlottesville, Virginia. Jeffrey.
Of course, as every week, our most important guests are all of you listening, and we'd like you to join in the conversation. So give us a call. Our phone number right here is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. David.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, live from New York and from the studios of KALW in San Francisco, welcome E. Jean Carroll and Robbie Kaplan. Ms. Carroll, your book was exquisitely well written. There wasn't a word wasted. I commend it to all our listeners. I bought it on a Thursday afternoon. By the time I went to sleep that evening, I'd read over 100 pages. Both of these, Ms. Kaplan, the legal work was categorically first class. Doesn't come any better. Both of these cases took enormous effort, enormous resources, and most importantly, enormous courage. Ms. Carroll, the next part is going to be a little bit difficult for you and a little bit painful. Please forgive me.
No, I won't forgive you. I don't like painful conversations, so go right ahead. And no need to say things like that.
Okay. Please tell us what happened in the dressing room there in Bergdorf Goodman.
Well, first of all, I want to say that my book is a high comedy. It stars characters that are so absurd and so ridiculous that I could not help myself but to write about why going to trial turned out to be so funny. It's a tragic event, true. But what went on behind the scenes, you're both lawyers, you're not at all surprised. I was shocked at how strange and almost ludicrous some of the things were that went on. And the juxtaposition of the dark, the tragedy, and the light and the comedy was, we were surrounded with it. And Robbie understands what I'm talking about. For instance, I had no idea that lawyers are some of the most superstitious people I have ever met. After I spent 3 days going through the story that you're begging me to tell you, David, after I was 3 days on the stand testifying, one of our great lawyers, Matt Craig, popped open champagne, and Robbie Kaplan scooted back her chair at about 50 miles an hour. She wouldn't touch the stuff, not until we won. So it was very strange for me. You think the strange thing was happening in the dressing room, but the consequences of going to trial against Donald Trump were also very strange and at times very difficult, but also particularly when Trump was in the courtroom, completely comical.
Well, would you like to tell us, at least in general terms, so that our audience knows what the cases were about, what happened there at Bergdorf Goodman?
Yes, I ran into Donald Trump in front of Bergdorf Goodman. I had a talk show at the time, and he watched a lot of TV, and he said, "Hey, you're that advice lady." And I said, "Hey, you're that real estate tycoon." And he said, "Come with me. I want to buy a gift for you, for a friend. Come advise me." I was delighted. So we went through the store. We ended up in the lingerie department. He asked me to put on a certain piece of lingerie. I told him to put on the lingerie. We were joking back and forth. It was very entertaining. I was a writer for Saturday Night Live. The whole scene reminded me of a sketch that I had written that was on Saturday Night Live. And he said, "Let's go put this on." I said it was his size, he should put them on. He said, "No, you would look good in this." I said, "No, it goes with your eyes." And he said, "After you," making a gesture towards the dressing room. I thought that I could make him put the lingerie on over his suit, over his pants. I thought, this is going to be the funniest thing, and I can't wait to dine out on this story. I went into the dressing room having that thought of, you know, something very funny. Turned dark. It was a terrible, terrible fight. I got out. We got out of the store, and that's what happened.
George Conway sent you to Robbie Kaplan. He steered you right. Would both of you like to tell us what the considerations were that you were thinking about when each of you decided whether to undertake the first case against Mr. Trump? What did you think was encouraging to taking the case, and what did you think were the hurdles and the dangers? And how did it feel?
You should go first on this, E, because it was really your call, so.
I arrived at the 73rd floor of the Empire State Building. I met around a very long table came this flash, this tiny, short, talking at 85 miles an hour, as fast as she could talk, coming right at me, stuck out her head and said, "Hi, I'm Robbie Kaplan." And oddly enough, I decided in that split second to do whatever Robbie told me to do. And that's how I decided. It was in a blink of a second, just shaking her hand. And as it turned out, I was correct, because she laid out the entire case that very afternoon I met her, laid out the entire case, including going to the Supreme Court. That's how far ahead this case was planned. From the minute I met her, she was already planning on how we work with the Supreme Court when he appeals the decision. Do you remember that, Robbie?
I do.
Yeah. Right to the Supreme Court.
I wish I'd predicted that one wrong, but you're right. I did say that.
Yeah.
Robbie, what were you thinking in terms of the pros and cons of going forward with the case?
So at that point, I had some experience. This was kind of at the height of Me Too and that movement and the Harvey Weinstein stuff. It was about a year old, not even a year old, maybe then. And so I had some experience in this world, and I knew very well how hard it is to prove cases of sexual assault, particularly if they happen years before, particularly if the person who was assaulted didn't go to the police at the time, and particularly if the alleged assailant was someone who was well-known and popular and powerful. So I was going into it, I was very well aware of all those things. And I'll be honest, I don't think everyone on my team necessarily agreed with me that day. But when E. Jean came into the room and I saw, A, how articulate she was, how charming and articulate she was, how attractive she was. I hate to have to say that, but it was relevant here. And E. Jean explains in her book why. The fact that she had told two friends who had remained her good friends, one immediately afterwards and one a day or two afterwards, the story. And frankly, the fact that the story was so odd, it was so kind of bizarre in its details, that if you were going to make up a lie about being assaulted by Donald Trump, this is not the lie you would make up. You just wouldn't say it happened in a dressing room. You would say it happened in his private office or in his private apartment. I mean, everything about it, to me, suggested that she was absolutely telling the truth. It happened, and that particularly with the corroborating witnesses, we would be able to prove our case.
You mentioned about the difficulty in proving a sexual assault case that happened years ago. Why was there that delay?
Well, E. Jean should explain the details, but the two friends she told gave her very different advice, both very much with E. Jean's best interest in mind. The first person she told, Lisa Birnbach, the comedy writer who wrote the Preppy Handbook, which was immediately after it happened, said to E., "E., you've been raped. You should go to the district attorney. I'll go with you. This is rape." E. Jean said to Lisa, "I don't want to talk about it ever again. I don't want to go to the police. Let's never talk about it." The friend that she told a day or two later is a friend from work, Carol Martin, who's a TV newscaster in New York City. And Carol gave her the opposite advice, said, "Do not go to the police. He'll get 200 lawyers against you. He'll crush you. It's not a good idea." And to be honest, I hate to say this, but to be honest, in 1996, I think Carol gave her the better advice. Had E. Jean gone to the DA and the police at that point in time, I think it's very unlikely they would have pursued the case. And Donald Trump indeed would have done everything in his power to crush her. I think actually Roy Cohn was still alive. I don't know when Roy Cohn died. But if he were still alive, he probably would have gotten Roy Cohn to crush you, E. Jean. So yeah. It wasn't a crazy thing. The world was a very different place in terms of how our society, how the legal system, how prosecutors dealt with these issues.
I think nothing's changed. I mean, I would have been fired immediately if I had come forward when it happened. My boss is Roger Ailes. He was a friend of Donald Trump. I would have been out on my ear. Elle did fire me when I came forward, so I would have been fired by both my bosses. We've seen how terribly Donald Trump has retaliated against when I came out. Can you imagine how he would retaliate if I had gone to the police? Going to the police would not have been the right move for me. It would not have been. It would have been a dumb thing. It was much easier for me not to go to the police, keep my job, and not receive retaliation from Donald Trump.
And, you know, Carol Martin, to this day, you know, feels some guilt about giving that advice, but I've told her 100 times it was the right advice at the time.
Oh, yeah. And I took it, too. Just absolutely. I saw Carol's reasoning. All she had to say was, "He has 200 lawyers. That's all I needed to hear. That would scare anybody. I mean, Robbie, you're one single lawyer and you scare everybody. Imagine 200 of you. I mean, come on. See, it's, yeah, and I'm like, I was a normal person. I didn't even know a lawyer at the time. So it was terrifying. And I don't, we know the statistics. There's a reason people don't, women don't go to the police.
This was no ordinary case.
Yeah.
You've touched on this a little bit, but when you first decided to go forward, what were you trying to accomplish in addition to suing for money? At the end of our program, I'll ask you how you feel about whether you've accomplished those things. But for right now, what were you trying to accomplish?
I'm wearing my name back. He called me a liar 26 times in 3 days. That's what we wanted to accomplish. That's what we set out to do. And pretty much that's what we did, I think.
Robbie?
Yeah, I think, you know, Eugene is a very accomplished journalist. She got her start in new journalism, writing the truth about what she was seeing. And for Donald Trump to come out and call her a liar, crazy, part of a political conspiracy, made it up for the money, a whack job. I'm sure I'm not even covering up, not his type. The way he did when she first told her story was terribly destructive to her reputation that she'd spent decades building. As she said, she was basically fired from her job at E. It was the longest advice column that ever run in the United States, and they fired her on the spot. She lost readers. She lost a steady income. And she wanted her reputation back as a truth teller, which is what and who she is.
For our listening audience, will you tell them what the legal and factual claims were in the first trial?
So the case got a little bit confusing because what the case that we filed second is the case that was tried first. So let me try to go through that as simply as I can. So the original case that Eugene filed, she filed in she made her statements in the summer of 2019. We filed in the fall of 2019. And because the statute of limitations had run on the original assault, that case was solely for defamation based on 3 days of, we call it defamatory tirade, rampage, that Trump went on after her original book that told the story had come out. Later in the case, two things happened. One, New York State, like many other states, passed a law called the Adult Survivor Act that let women bring claims for sexual assault that had already been told for like about a 1 year look back period. So that look back period, as I recall, E, came into effect beginning of Thanksgiving 2020 or 2022. I'm sorry. And we filed the first day it came into effect, that second case, which was one for the underlying assault and two for some defamation that Trump had engaged in during the case itself. Because of some very complicated issues having to do with the Westfall Act, the Federal Tort Claims Act, and ultimately presidential immunity, that first case did not get tried first, it got tried second. But because we were trying the underlying defamation and the underlying assault, by the time we got to the second trial, most of it had already been decided by the jury, and it was a much more limited trial for those reasons.
Eugene,
I don't know if that makes any sense. I tried to explain it.
Yeah, it makes good sense. Eugene, you testified for about 3 days before the jury in the Southern District of New York, first on direct testimony and then on cross-examination.
Yeah.
Your lawyers did a superb job of preparing you.
Yes, they did.
I know that. Jeffrey knows it. All our lawyers in the audience know it, too. And I wanted to ask you, how did it feel when you were going through the preparation for the direct examination? And how did it feel about going through the preparation for the cross-examination?
Hideous! Horrible! You know, they just came and they scraped layer after layer off me. I went in weighing 320 pounds and I came out weighing a nice slender 110. They had to get me To keep my answer short. Keep my answer short. And when I would give them a short answer, they would want that answer even shorter. So I got the impression that if I just didn't say anything at all, it would be better. So it was even a simple question like, where are you from? They were very, and they couldn't tell me what to say. I begged them. I just said, just tell me what to say. Just tell me what to say. And I will say it. But no, they wouldn't tell me what to say. So I would, they'd say, where are you from, Miss Carol? And then they didn't like what I'd say because I was, I'm from the sticks of Indiana. And then I would get a very bad look from the prep team. And they'd say, where are you from, Miss Carol? I'd say, well, I'm from the hills, which are behind the sticks in Indiana. And it was, I would get bad looks again. And it was over and over and over until I said the magic words, rural Indiana. Okay, they'll take that. And I thought it was just boring as hell. But they made it clear that when you testify, the jury just wants the facts. That's what the jury wants. The jury wants to decide what this case is about. They just want to hear the facts. And they finally got me to do, to just give the facts. And it was, oh, because I'm a journalist and I like to dramatize certain things. They don't want me to dramatize when I'm on the witness stand. They don't want any of that. So it was very difficult for me.
Robbie, how did it feel for you when you were preparing Eugene? And how do you feel about the way that she's describing it now? These things look different to the lawyer.
So I agree with almost everything Eugene said. You know, there was a balance that we were trying to achieve. And the balance was between the process that Eugene just described to you, which is Eugene, you know, being the great writer and journalist that she is, has a tendency to, how should I say it, elaborate somewhat significantly in answering any single question. And some of that was too much. But on the other hand, we had to let Eugene be Eugene. Eugene was going to testify like an FBI agent in a criminal case. She had to testify like Eugene, and the jury should see her charm and her kind of her self, her real self on the stand. So we were constantly balancing those two. I think we came up in the came out ultimately in the right place, but it was a lot of work to get there. The other thing is Eugene had a very hard time, and this was partly through our expert as well, had a very hard time admitting that she had been very seriously damaged by what Trump did to her. Eugene's the person, whenever you ask her how she is, her answer is fabulous. And I don't know how many times, how many hours it took us, many hours to get Eugene to admit that when she says fabulous, she doesn't always mean fabulous. And maybe on the stand, she should be somewhat more honest about the negative parts of her life and the negative things that happened.
Yeah, that was rough.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Jeff Hayden, joined by co-host David Bigelizen. Tonight, a story of abuse, of survival, of litigating with a man who, already one of the most litigious persons in history, transitioned himself later to become the world's most powerful person. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding anything on tonight's topic. You want to chat with Eugene Carroll about her experience before, after the litigation. You want to talk to her attorney. You don't have to jump in the exact moment we are in our conversation.
Eugene, Joe Tacopina cross-examined you for 3 days. Tell us what that was like.
Well, Joe Tacopina is probably the premier criminal defense lawyer in the country. He's magnificently built, looks like Popeye, has his hair glowing with brilliantine, wears $6,000 suits. He's very dramatic. And that man beat up on me bad, just beat up on me and beat up on me and beat up. He had a lot of ploys. He had a lot of insinuations. He was he did the worst thing he could have done to win his case by living in the 15th century and trying to convince the jury that because I attended a party or two, and because I said I was fabulous, and because I didn't scream, it couldn't have happened. But on the other hand, he told the jury that Trump was not there and that Trump did not know who I was. On the other hand, he kept asking me why I didn't scream. So Robbie, did it make any sense to keep asking me why I didn't scream when his whole case was Trump didn't know who I was and was not there? So it was very he put on a brilliant case if you happen to be living in the 17th century. That's the case he put on. And he put it on brilliantly. And that I think, listen, he's an extremely talented man. I think that was not his case. I think he was doing what Trump told him to do. What do you think, Robbie? You think those were, Robbie, I've never asked you that question. Do you think Trump was just telling him, go beat up on E. Jean, or ask her why she didn't scream, or?
Yes. I mean, not to the degree to which he did that to Haba at the second trial, but I think the overall strategy in terms of what to pursue at Cross and what not to pursue, that was for sure, that was dictated by Donald Trump.
Do you think that beating up on the complaining witness was effective in this particular case, Robbie?
Completely the opposite. I think E. Jean, as many good witnesses do, was best on cross.
Yeah.
She at some point said to Joe, like, why do you keep asking me why I didn't scream? He raped me. I didn't scream. And, I don't know. Joe didn't have a lot to work with. I mean, we had corroboration. We had Donald Trump's own deposition. We had E. Jean. He didn't have a lot to work with at all. But in a lot of ways, I think that the cross-examination really backfired.
Jeffrey.
Well, Robbie, you put on 11 witnesses.
Yeah.
And he beat up on two of the grandmothers. Just beat up on them.
Correct.
Jeffrey.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. And we'll be back right after this.
Pam, you wanted us to come to class that next day, having spent the entire day taking a risk, doing something, changing your appearance or your behavior or routine in a way that makes you feel completely vulnerable, which I had spent my adolescence avoiding at all costs.
Join us for stories about making the best of things. That's on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
The Moth Radio Hour tonight at 7 o'clock here on 91.7 FM, KALW San Francisco, and online at kalw.org, where support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information as we now return it back to Your Legal Rights.
Robbie, set the stage for us. When did case number one go to trial?
E. Jean's going to have the dates better than me because she just wrote the book. Case one
January 24 on the 83.3 million. January 24.
Okay. That's the first case, the second trial.
Yes. Yeah.
The first trial happened about 6 months earlier.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to go back to the first trial. Eugene, Robbie introduced you to Dr. Leibowitz. I have two questions for you. The first question is, how did Dr. Leibowitz help you to get in touch with yourself so that you would be prepared to testify at trial? And then the second question is, what did Dr. Leibowitz tell the jury that helped the case?
Well, I'd never been to a therapist. And being examined by Dr. Leslie Leibowitz, one of the world's leading trauma experts. She created the sexual assault protocol for the United States Air Force. She created the sexual protocol trauma for the United States Veterans Association. She is famous for her Harvard rape studies, and she was even more famous for her Duke rape studies. This is one of the experts. And it was 3 days with her. And at the end of it, I had a severe stomach ache because she made me realize how much I had been damaged. I was, the fallout from that, from the event in Bergdorf's, was massive. And she helped me. I had all along realized there had been damage, but I just couldn't admit it to myself. So that's what she did. And when she spoke to the jury, she was absolutely wonderful because she didn't use any long psychological words. She didn't do that. What she did was just tell the jury stories. That's all she did. The jury, when she got off the stand, they understood the consequences of what Trump did better than if Sigmund Freud himself had testified. She was absolutely astounding.
Robbie, there were two parts that hit the news in this case that I think we should tell our audience about. And they came up in a deposition of Donald Trump. For our audience, a deposition is a court hearing that takes place in the lawyer's office where the witness is examined under oath. And the first item was a photograph that you showed to Mr. Trump. Would you tell us about that and how that came up in the trial and how it figured?
Sure. Actually, the deposition here was at Mar-a-Lago. So we were sitting at Mar-a-Lago I don't even call it a conference room, kind of a breakfast room, I think is where it took place. And Donald Trump at some point said, I never met her. I didn't know her. I know there's a photo, but I didn't know who Jean was. Maybe I met her like on a receiving line at a party or something like that. And I was just honestly trying to create a record. I mean, I've been known to try to, in my past, to try to confuse a witness, but I wasn't trying that here at all. I said, I think I have that photo. And I had someone pull it out and he looked at it and he pointed to Eugene and said, that's Marla. And I said, who? And he said, that's my wife, Marla Maples. Then Alina Haba, who was defending with the deposition, immediately jumped in and told him that it was Eugene. And then Trump did what Trump always does when he's caught in a mistake, and he made up another lie. And he said, the photo's really blurry. It's blurry. That's why I misidentified Eugene as Marla. The reason that was so relevant is one of the things that Trump had said in that 3-day rampage of defamatory rampage is that Eugene wasn't his type. Well, that didn't work so well because he looked at a photo of Eugene probably a few years before the assault happened and looked at her and said it was Marla Maples. And later at the deposition, I think I got him to admit that all the women he married were in fact his type.
I would imagine so. The other thing that I wanted to ask you about was there was the Access Hollywood tape, which a lot of people know about. Can you tell us about the tape, what was on the tape, what were Mr. Trump's comments during the deposition, and how did that figure in the trial?
So this tape is famous. It became a big deal during the campaign. There is a videotape of Trump with Billy Bush coming in on a bus, apparently at the beginning, and then getting off the bus to go into some kind of an event. And on the bus, and it kind of even as they're continuing off the bus, Trump is on the hot mic bragging to Billy Bush about how kind of his typical MO with women. And he says things like he takes some mints and then he just starts kissing them. He can't help himself. He just starts kissing them. And at another point, he says, I apologize for the language here. He says he grabs them by the pussy. And again, you know, he said it was locker room talk. It's pretty crude language, but he's clearly on the videotape kind of bragging about something that was his usual practice that he'd done in the past, that he intended to do again, and was basically the way he treated women. It was relevant in at the trial for two reasons. One, as Judge Kaplan concluded, he was basically telling a story about a particular woman who he'd taken shopping, by the way, where he did this to this woman. And so it was essentially a prior similar act. And it was also a confession of Trump saying, yes, I'd done this to women in the past. It also was very, and we played it for the tape jury, I don't know, two or three times, certainly during my closing.
Yeah.
And during the trial itself, during the testimony itself. And then at the deposition at Mar-a-Lago, when I was questioning him about the videotape, which he obviously had to admit was true, he said something like, fortunately or unfortunately, what I said is on that tape is true. You can get, if you're a star, you can get away with it. And I said to him, well, I take it you yourself are a star. And he said, yes, I'm a star. So rather than saying what you would expect him to say is like, look, I was joking around with a guy, I was bragging, I was, you know, I was exaggerating, blah, blah, blah. He basically owned what he said in that videotape during the deposition. So that was obviously extremely helpful with the jury. Right.
Who prepared him for that deposition?
Alina Haba was defending him. I had the sense that they didn't spend a lot of time preparing.
I understand.
You also called two women to the stand who had been assaulted in separate incidents. Tell us a little about this. Why was this important in the trial? You already had the Access Hollywood tape.
And so again, our theory was, and it was consistent with what he said on the Access Hollywood tape, that Trump had a practice of kind of making nice chit-chat, flirty, whatever, chit-chat with someone, kind of joking around with a woman who he obviously was attracted to. And then all of a sudden, kind of out of thin air, he would just pounce on them. And it just like with the way E. Jean described happened to her, what was a pleasant kind of a jokey interaction would immediately and suddenly turn dark. And we had two women who had experienced very similar, were in very similar situations with Donald Trump. One was from a long time ago, 1979. A woman was on a plane with him. She was on a business trip. She got bumped up to first class. She was sitting next to him in first class on the plane. Again, similar pattern. They're having dinner. They're making nice chit chat. Everything seems fine. They clear away the dinner trays, and he literally pounces on her. She somehow managed, she had his hand up her skirt, she somehow managed to get away and move back to coach, and remembers it, you know, as if it had happened yesterday. Her name is Jessica Leeds. And then the second victim was someone that happened much later, actually happened after the assault on E. Jean Carroll, when a reporter by the name of Natasha Stoyanov was interviewing Trump down at Mar-a-Lago, and he suggested they go see some kind of artwork or something. And one of the rooms there, they're kind of walking around, joking. They get into this room that he wanted to show her the supposed painting. He slams the door, pushes her up against the wall, and again tries to Salter. She was actually saved because the butler came in and Trump had to stop what he was doing. So we thought that those two stories were very, very similar in many respects. Not only this pattern of kind of friendly chit-chat followed by kind of this sudden attack, but neither Jessica Leeds nor Natasha Stoyanov really needed or wanted anything from Donald Trump, right? Same thing with E. Jean Carroll. Like she, you know, she knew who he was. She thought it would be a great story to tell her writer friends about that she helped him pick out a gift, but she wasn't looking for a job or a favor or money or anything like that from Donald Trump. And these two women, Stoyanov and Leeds, weren't exactly, in my view, in the same situation.
I'm going to ask you about one more witness, and then we'll talk about what the jury thought about the case. You had a witness who described the damages from the defamation. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so, I mean, from as we were getting the case prepared for trial, you know, I had this kind of wave of fear come over me. It's like, how do we prove the damages? Like, how do you do this in today's world, particularly when information, as it happened here, travels instantaneously all over the world and is repeated day after minute after minute and then commented on by untold thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. Well, it turns out that there are professors, including this professor we used from Northwestern, who have developed a methodology for kind of assessing the number of times and the number of people who saw allegedly defamatory statements, talking about their reach, kind of doing a numerical analysis, and then computing from that what it would take to run a countervailing narrative on social media that would make up for the defamation. And so we put her on the stand to do that. She testified earlier in the Ruby Freeman trial against Rudy Giuliani. So this wasn't her first time on the stand doing this. And she was just incredibly powerful. I think she testified at Ruby Freeman. I'm pretty sure she did. She was incredibly powerful explaining to the jury that, you know, it's not like the old days where there's a New York Times story or a Time Magazine story and it's that's it. And people read it and your reputation's injured. In today's world, the story, it's like, you know, it's like a cancer cell. It travels immediately everywhere for the rest of time. And so she did a very good job of economically assessing what it would take to try to rehabilitate someone under those circumstances.
Did Mr. Trump testify?
Not at the first trial, no.
Okay.
He didn't even show up.
And did Mr. Trump's team put on a case?
Well, they did. No, they did not. The Sunday before, when we closed our case, rested our case, Judge Kaplan, even though they had already said that Donald Trump wouldn't be showing up or testifying, Judge Kaplan gave them, I think originally it was till 10 o'clock on Sunday, Eugene, and then I requested that they let us know by 5 p.m. on Sunday whether Donald Trump was going to show up. They gave him an opportunity to change his mind. And they did not change their minds. So they put on no case whatsoever. It was solely cross-examination of our witnesses.
Could you have put him on yourself?
I could have, but I had the deposition videotape, so I didn't need to.
And what did the jury decide?
The jury decided in less than 3 hours, which was, I think, shocking to all of us, that yes, Donald Trump had defamed E. Jean Carroll when he said the things he said about her. And yes, he had sexually assaulted her. And I'm going to put a pin on that for a second. In a dressing room at Bergdorf Goodman, we believe in the spring of 1996. The pin on that is New York had until very recently, a very antiquated definition of rape. In New York, you can only be guilty of rape under New York criminal statutes if a penis, excuse my language, is inserted in a woman's vagina. Most states don't have that language. New York has abandoned it as well. In her testimony, E. Jean testified, I'm sorry, E. Jean, for repeating this, in great detail about how painful it was for Donald Trump to use his hand, kind of, I think the word you used was rummaging around her body. And she remembers distinctly the way it felt and how painful it was and how horrible it was. She also testified that he then inserted his penis, but pretty quickly after that, she pushed him off and was able to leave the dressing room. So what the jury held by preponderance is certainly he had abused her with his fingers. I think they concluded that that evidence was so strong they didn't need to go to reach whether or not he penetrated her with his penis. And Joe Tacopina, in his closing argument, really begged the jury to find that Trump didn't rape her, that he, I mean, essentially he was saying that he abused her but didn't rape her. So that was the jury finding. Today it would be rape under New York law either way.
Let's now talk about the second trial. And E. Jean, in your book under the paragraph called The Dogs of War, you recite some of the communications that you received by email. Are you comfortable talking about some of that with our audience?
Yeah, I am, but I want to make it clear on the jury trial, the jury that went out and came in 3 hours on the first trial, that was not a Manhattan jury. That was an upstate jury. That jury was drawn from Trump counties. So the win that we won, and we won so quickly and so thoroughly, was astonishing. And I've always thought to this day that Trump probably should have testified, because he had people who really liked him on the jury. I'm wondering if Joe Tacopina, who said that he advised him not to come, if what would have happened if Trump, if he had come, David, Jeff, you know that Robbie Kaplan would have taken his head off and fed it to him in cross-examination. That was that danger. But I think because he's so persuasive, I mean, he's 6-time bankrupt, convinced America that he's a business genius, could certainly sway a couple of those people on. It was sort of a Trump jury. It was 6 men. Men love Trump.
No one from New York. I think there was one person from the Bronx, no one else from New York.
Yeah.
One person from Westchester, and everyone else was Orange, Dutchess.
Yeah.
They were all Trump counties.
Yeah. And as for your second question, yes, the threats were unbelievable. The people, Donald Trump said, here's the case that Robbie proved. She takes a statement from Donald Trump, pulls a sentence out from one of his 3 harangues, and then proved through all the messages that came in that they repeated his language, and then many of them added a threat to the language of Trump. She actually proved it, and she did it by minute. It was a brilliant presentation. So it was difficult for me to talk about him, because when I saw a threat, let's say it's about a gun being put in my mouth, I just see the gun in my mouth. And I think it's going to go off. It all went into your heads too, right? When I said gun in my mouth, you all picture a gun. Okay, that's what it's like when you're on the witness stand, and I couldn't talk because I had a gun in my mouth and my whole body was reacting to the gun in my mouth. So Dr. Leslie Leibowitz, who Robbie made me call so I could talk, explained to me, Jean, you don't have to explain anything except what's going on in your body. Just say, I can't breathe, if you can't breathe. Or my eyes are going fuzzy because I can't see what it is. So that's how we did it. She got me over it. And Robbie introduced 56 pieces of evidence in under 3 hours. And the jury was gobsmacked by it, just gobsmacked. And it's very effective.
This was in the second trial, the defamation trial, correct?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay.
Because of the first trial, Judge Kaplan had concluded correctly that we didn't need to prove the assault anymore. That had been proven.
Yeah.
And we didn't even have to prove the defamatory nature of the statement, because the statement that was at issue in the first trial was essentially the same, although it was longer in the second trial. And so we were really just proving damages.
Yeah.
So how long was the second trial?
7 days.
5 days? What?
It was, well, we had people coming down with COVID during it, so we kept.
So there were a couple breaks.
There were a couple of breaks.
Six trial days, maybe? Yeah. After six trial days.
And during the second, Donald Trump sat through the entire second trial. Was he on his best behavior?
Yeah, he was perfect, man. He was absolutely perfect. He never shut up. He whammed and complained and moaned and groaned and belittled Alina Haba and would say under his breath, I never met her. I don't know who she is. He humped. He banged the desk. He called the judge a nasty man. The jury was mesmerized by him. Mesmerized to see how an adult man with his hair all done up like Barbara Stanwyck in Ball of Fire and his apricot makeup. And he looked very old and very fat, but he was very complaining. The man just moaned and complained. It was an amazing thing to watch. But the high point of the whole trial was Robbie Kaplan takes over the lectern and begins this final argument. And she is going to town. She drove him so crazy with her final arguments, the man stood up and walked out of court. It was the jury, their jaws hung up, because that's what a guilty man does. A guilty man just gets up and runs. They're like, Robbie didn't even know it. Robbie just keeps up because he had walked out behind her. And Judge Kaplan said, for the record, did he say the plaintiff has just, or did he say Mr. Trump has left?
Mr. Trump, I think he said.
That was.
Mr. Trump has left the courtroom.
Yeah, it was.
Robbie.
And then the other thing that Eugene did mention is every day he'd sit in the court and he'd moan and groan, as Eugene said, and then court would end and he would go to some office building. I don't think it was Trump Tower, some office building somewhere. And he would repeat the defamation.
Yeah.
The same Eugene half a dozen times during the trial. Mm-hmm. So, which was on videotape, and all of which I showed to the jury in my closing.
Yeah, that's what she did. She showed him on the camera. She took everything he was saying after the trial every day and showed it to the jury in court. It was a masterwork. It was just unbelievable. Yeah.
We have a caller on the line, Peter from Florida. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. I'm listening to this, and it occurred to me what came the most famous thing before this was the Monica Lewinsky and Bill Clinton, and when Bill Clinton looked at the TV and said, "I did not have sex with that woman," and my feeling was, as soon as he said that, I said he's lying. Because you were just talking about the words. Because he said, "I didn't," he said, "I did not have sex with that woman." And saying "that woman" instead of Monica. There are just, anyway, so what I would like you to do is just kind of, what would you say, I mean, in terms of what happened with Trump? The telltale things that said, oh, he's lying through his teeth. You know what I'm saying?
What Peter's getting at is what tells did he give? I mean, think of yourself as sitting at a poker table and somebody does something. They may scratch their head. They may rub their eye. They do something that lets you know they're bluffing or they're lying in this case. What did Donald Trump do in the trial that let everyone in the room know that he was lying?
Are you kidding? Have you ever seen almost every word that came out of his mouth during the trial was a lie? There are no tells. His entire body was a tell. Now, Robbie has people have theories about the tells, but it's, from my point of view, it's impossible that when a man has a hurricane of made-up lies constantly spewing from his mouth, it doesn't make any difference which exact word, which exact contraction of a word actually showed you that it's a lie. when he got up and walked out of court, I would guess that was the main tell. He couldn't take it. He ran like a bunny.
And then pointing it at the photo of Eugene at his deposition and saying that's Marla Maples.
Yeah.
That was a bit of a tell.
Well, and then saying, yeah.
After saying basically she was too ugly for me to rape.
Robbie, all competent lawyers know that when they have a client who is a little bit headstrong, they prepare him for trial and they say, you sit there, you keep quiet, you look straight ahead, you don't make any faces. If you want to communicate with me, you write a note to me. Sit still. That was not Mr. Trump.
No.
And his lawyer did not stomp on his foot, didn't stand up and put her hand on his shoulder and squeeze it and say, sit down, be quiet, or any of those things. How do you think that went over with the jury?
Terribly. I mean, Judge Kaplan is a very, very smart man, a very experienced judge. He's done a lot of trials. He commands his courtroom the way I think a good judge should. And the just repeated disrespect that Trump showed to Judge Kaplan, to the courtroom, to the judicial system, to me, to Eugene, almost everyone in that courtroom repeatedly throughout the trial was just, I mean, the jury saw it for what it was. I mean, I think they were pretty horrified by it by the end.
What did the jury decide?
We got a verdict of $83.3 million.
And is it on appeal now?
Both of them are on appeal. The first trial, we're almost at the end. We've won every round, including an en banc request at the Second Circuit that the Second Circuit turned down. They've said they're going to try to go to SCOTUS. I don't think they have too many more days left to file that. I would be very, very, very surprised if SCOTUS were interested. There's really no SCOTUS-worthy issue. The only issue is really about the prior witnesses. The prior victims, and the Second Circuit said even if they hadn't come in, it would have been harmless given all the other testimony. So that's the first trial. The second trial, we have one, there are two issues on appeal now. One has to do with presidential immunity. One has to do with the Westfall Act. We got the Westfall Act decision, and we're waiting for the merits decision on presidential immunity.
And did Mr. Trump post a bond on these cases?
The first one, he deposited the money with the Southern District, which I've never seen anyone do before, but he just deposited the money. The second one was bonded by Chubb.
One last question. We're almost out of time, but I have to ask both of you. Any blowback from the current administration following these verdicts? I mean, are you hearing from MAGA people? Are you hearing from the administration?
Eugene should answer that first. I hope you're not hearing from the administration, because if you have been, I would want to know about it already. So I hope the answer to that one is no.
We're out of town. I just did a real quick yes or no. Are you hearing stuff?
Nope.
That'll be the last word. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight we've been talking about surviving a lawsuit against two lawsuits against one of the most litigious individuals anywhere, ever. Now arguably the most powerful individual in the world. Our guests tonight have been writer Eugene Carroll and attorney Roberta Kaplan. Join us next week, where we celebrate the career of one of the great criminal defense lawyers ever to arise out of this region. You will have a chance to sit down for an evening with J. Tony Serra. A big thanks to tonight's guests and to all of you for listening. And for this evening's co-host, David Bigelizen, and the controls, D Minor, I'm Jeff Hayden. Be safe and zealously guard your legal rights.